Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by 100 Bogart Street, a co-working and event space in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Learn more at 100bogart.com. I'm HRN's Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three.
I think we should realize that we more or less have a broken food system. When 800 million of us go to bed hungry, 600 million are obese, we waste 30% of our food, then something is fundamentally wrong.
We'll introduce you to one food waste solution happening in Asia.
They introduced this system where residents were issued an electronic ID card that would open an automated bin and enable them to weigh the food waste being dropped off. And then they would be charged, you know, in a certain amount of money for the weight of that food.
And we'll take a look at some of the real struggles happening closer to home.
How is it possible that a meal that was perfectly fine to consume at 10:59 p.m. then becomes waste at 11 p.m.
So tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Good evening and welcome to
Fun Man About It
on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izette.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And we're your co-hosts through this weekly journey of all things fermented.
We are off-site, outside in the studio right now at Fifth Hammer Brewing Company in our tap room, welcoming our very special guest, Scott Ungerman of Anchor Brewing Company. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to New York.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
So how long have you been brewmaster at Anchor?
About 4.5 years I've been with Anchor.
Cool. And how'd you get into brewing?
How did I get into brewing? So I got into brewing really a long time ago. I first toured the Anchor Brewery back in the 80s when I was in college. It was what kind of inspired me to become a home brewer. When I first went there with a group of my buddies, one of my really close friends and I, like a week later, went to a homebrew store because we were told there, like we asked a ton of questions and of course we drank a ton of beer and just got totally enthused about it. And turns out there's a homebrew store that's still there in Berkeley called the Oak Barrel, where we went in a week later and bought our first homebrewing kit and made our first beer. And for me, it was a hobby for quite some time. I was actually an English major undergrad at Berkeley. And I went and I got a job teaching high school right after college. And my mom sent me an article. I kind of knew I wanted to go to grad school, but I didn't know in what. And my mom sent me an article on the program, the brewing program at UC Davis. And that was like my light bulb moment of, wow, I could go back to school. I could study brewing. And that's what I did. It took me a while to, like, I went to junior college first down in Ventura to take the prerequisites that I had avoided as an undergraduate. and got myself into brewing school and really had the vision that I was going to get out of brewing school and kind of start my own brewery or, you know, live the dream in some way. But what happened was life kind of got in the way. My wife got a promotion with her job while I was finishing up graduate school that moved us out to the East Coast, out here to New Jersey. Not quite here, almost here. But so moving into New Jersey in the mid-90s, looking for a brewing job, there were not a lot of opportunities. I got one interview from a couple who wanted to start up a brewery and wanted to pay me exactly nothing to help them start their brewery, and I declined that offer. But I interviewed at the two big breweries that were available at the time, Anheuser-Busch in Newark and Stroh's out in Allentown, because we were smack dab in the middle of New Jersey, so I could go either way. But I got a job in Newark and kind of never looked back. I thought I was just going to work there for a couple of years, but it turned into a career and moved us back across the country. 7 years in Newark, 2 years in Columbus, Ohio, 2 years in St. Louis, and then back to the West Coast, where I eventually became brewmaster of the brewery in Fairfield. Moved back to Davis, came kind of full circle with them. But then, you know, I needed to get out at some point. I spent 18 years making Budweiser, which I enjoyed, and I learned a lot. I learned a ton. And became a brewmaster, one of the 12 AB brewmasters in the country at the time. And so I enjoyed that job, but I was getting burnt out, and it certainly became more about making money than making beer once InBev took over.
Right.
And I just wanted to get back to my roots, and the Anchor job came open at exactly the right time.
Awesome.
And it was really just a complete leap of faith. And so for me, it's coming full circle to come back to Anchor. We'll taste Christmas ale a little later.
Yes.
And I collected Christmas ale bottles as a kid.
Still do.
And that's awesome.
Yeah. And I brought my collection back to the brewery.
That's
how full circle it's come for me. So.
That's an awesome story.
Do you remember what that first beer was that you made when you got that brew kit?
Yeah. We made a nut brown ale.
A nut brown ale,
like the Samuel Smith's kind of knockoff.
Sure.
It was delicious. That was like what got us hooked, is that first beer was great. And then we had many failures after that, but the first one kind of got us hooked. It was super delicious.
I'm always fascinated by people's first beer, because oftentimes brewers start brewing because they can't get a certain beer, or they brew outside of their warehouse because they can't be there.
No, this is mid-80s California. We were, we were awakened to craft beer. I toured the Anchor Brewery, we drank Anchor Steam. That was our special beer. We drank a lot of Lucky Lager and generic beer and Wiedemann's and Schmidt's and Pabst and Coors and Bud and all that, because we were in college and it was cheap. But when we were having a special event, it was Anchor Steam or Anchor Porter.
And how old was Anchor at that time, or how old is Anchor?
Well, Anchor's been around in San Francisco since 1896. Yeah, it's a storied old brewery. It really had a rebirth in 1965 when Fritz Maytag bought the brewery.
Yeah.
But we trace our roots all the way back, and actually deeper than that. It was under a different name. The Golden City Brewery was founded by Gottlieb Brickles back in 1871. And so one of the early steam beer breweries in San Francisco. And then it transformed to Anchor Brewing when two other German immigrants, Ernst Beruth and Gottlieb Schinkel? Otto Schinkel. Otto Schinkel. Got the names right.
Gottlieb Otto Schinkel.
Otto.
So it was one of the first... So one of the only steam breweries. What is steam?
What does it mean? That's a beer you have in your glass right now.
Steam beer is one of my favorite beer stories, and I think it's when I first started homebrewing, because it's an American beverage.
There's really only two indigenous American styles. Now there are many more, but old school, original American styles that date back to now a couple centuries ago, right? But steam beer. And cream ale, which you obviously have in New York State, famous cream ale. I was actually born in New York, in Rochester, but never really been there. We moved away when I was 3 months old.
Oh, great.
Steam beer is, it's a unique California thing, and it got its nickname because of steam coming off the roofs of the brewery when they were cooling the wort in open cool ships. So put yourself in 1850s technology in California. There was no beer making history, right? The people who came out for the gold rush in thousands of people came to California in a hurry looking for gold. Not all of them were looking for the kind of gold you get in the hills. Some were looking for golden nectar that you could put in a glass, And primarily, this is true over most of the world, the German brewing technology has really what what spread. And it's German brewers, and you heard the names of Gottlieb Breckelsen and Otto Schinkel and Ernst Baruth. Those are Germans.
Yeah.
And they came out with visions of making beer. And there were many others. And they brought with them lager yeast from Germany. And they wanted to ferment their lagers cool like they did in Germany. And they were, you know, they had caves for aging beer there. And they had ice that they could store year round. These things didn't exist in California and the West Coast in the 1850s, 60s, 70s. So they had to improvise. And one of the improvisations that they did was to cool in open cool ships in the nice cool nighttime air in San Francisco, which is, you know, a balmy 60 degrees pretty much year round. And then they would ferment in open fermenters. The nickname of steam beer was really from the steam coming off the roof. There's a couple other, it's not clearly documented really where the name came from, but that was what they called California beers, steam beers. And after Prohibition, there were, like, steam beer was basically gone, but Anchor Brewing opened back up and kept making steam beer in San Francisco, and still with cool ships and still with open fermentation. And they were about to go out of business in 1965 when Fritz Maytag bought the brewery for really on the cheap. They were, I mean, it was a going out of business sale. They were down to their last three accounts in San Francisco, and Fritz was served a beer and told, this is going to be your last steam beer. And Fritz didn't want to have that happen, and he knew that the beer could be beautiful when it was beautiful, but he also knew that there were some difficulties with consistency. And so, you know, one of the first things he did was he bought himself a microscope, and he bought himself a bunch of brewing books, because he like me, wasn't a brewing major undergrad. Stanford, he was a history major, but he learned, and he studied, and you know, he saved the style of beer from vanishing. In 1965, if that brewery would have closed, steam beer would have been a footnote in history. Yeah. But it's, you know, the unique thing about it, getting to what it is, the essence of it, it's a lager fermented at a warm temperature in an open fermentation. And so that's the most unique part about what we do. We have this beautiful copper brew house. When you come in and you see it, it's just a glorious place. Mm-hmm. But when you go around the corner and you see those open fermenters, that's the, like, mind-bending moment. These 100-barrel open fermenters, this beautiful head of foam over the top of them, and that's the beauty of steam.
Yeah. And you, I mean, I've, there was no open fermentation at Budweiser or at any of those plants, right?
No.
And so the geometry of fermentation happens a little bit differently with that. So what are the differences in the shape of the fermentation?
Yeah, shape is important. Pressure is important, too. So at Anheuser-Busch, we actually did have horizontal fermenters and vertical fermenters. And, like, you can taste the difference between a Budweiser brewed and a horizontal fermenter and a vertical. It's just the horizontal ones are much more estery because there's less back pressure on the yeast. Mm-hmm. Now, think about an open fermentation that's only about 2 feet deep. Very little back pressure. Zero, practically. So that open fermentation produces a super estery profile, especially with a warm fermentation. I mean, that's what you get especially as this beer opens up in this glass, you smell those esters. You smell that banana and a little bit of roses. And
so you're talking our language. So we know that generally we're brewing, even on a homebrew scale, we're brewing either with cylindrical, conical, things that are tall, more tall than they are wide. But in open fermentation, you want kind of shallow and wide.
Super shallow. Yeah, so they take up a lot of real estate.
Yeah.
But we actually have two different styles of open fermentation. We have our the ones that we use for steam beer and lager are super wide, so they look like swimming pools, but they're only 2.5 feet deep, and that's, you know, 100 barrel fermenters, and then we have the 200 barrel fermenters upstairs that are even bigger, but wow, still super shallow with very little pressure on them. The ale fermenters, we have an open ale fermenter that is more kind of a Yorkshire square type of geometry, so a little steeper, a little deeper, But it's, we ferment those pretty warm, and so they also produce a nice estuary ale. If you're familiar with Liberty Ale, we brew that.
Absolutely.
We brew that in those open fermentation. And when we taste Christmas Ale later, that's in open fermentations too.
I'm excited to get that.
Talk a little bit about the differences, kind of the technical differences in open versus closed fermentation as far as, you know, yeast pitching or cleaning or just, cropping, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so first off, from yeast pitching, one of the most astounding facts for me, actually the single most astounding fact for me when I came to Anchor was that the yeast is constantly harvested and repitched and never propagated from any kind of yeast lab or anything. We're at thousands of generations. If you calculate every 3 days back to 1979, and we crop that yeast. It's a true bottom fermenting yeast. So the slope of the tank is very gentle on the bottom, but then there's a trough in the center, and the yeast settles in that trough quite nicely. So as a true bottom fermenting yeast that settles in the trough, you can harvest it by hand, and that's what we do. We have a little positive displacement pump and some hoses that go to the brink, but there's a guy who climbs in the tank and scrubs down his boots, obviously, first, and then he's walking in the tank, but the yeast that we're harvesting is in the trough, so he pushes that into the pump, pumps it into the brink, and then we store it there until our next pitch. So it's just harvest and repitch. Everything's hand cleaned. It's tedious.
Wow.
Yeah.
But it's, there are people who, we have fermentation people who, that's what they do. They clean tanks and they pump beer. And the cleaning is by hand. And
that's
they harvest
awesome.
Yeast and repitch, and then the brewers repitch the yeast.
That's awesome.
And real quick, if I'm not, not treading on any proprietary secrets or stuff, but this is, a steam beer is, it's a lager yeast fermented at an ale temperature or a warmer temperature.
Warmer.
What
we actually
kind of temperature
cool,
are you dealing with?
We cool to 60 degrees.
Okay.
So I have no problem sharing all the particulars.
Okay. Fantastic.
We cool to 60 degrees. And then the other unique property of our tanks is there's no cooling jacket. So it is a free rise fermentation that is completely controlled by the yeast and the air temperature.
Okay.
So we have cold filtered
room.
Yeah, we control the room also at 60 degrees.
Okay.
So we cool the wort to 60 degrees, pitch at 60, and then it naturally warms up over a pretty quick 3-day fermentation to roughly 72 to 74 degrees, depending on the vigor of the fermentation.
Sure.
But we have a temperature chart that we record, and it's generally between 72 to 74. So pretty warm. And then starts to cool down. And then it's a two-stage fermentation. So we do that. Primary fermentation is open, relatively warm. We drop then down, is it in a physically a gravity drop, two floors down to our cellar where we have closed tanks that are pressure regulated, and we actually Kroisen the beer. So we add roughly 15% of fresh wort and yeast that is less than a one-day fermentation. So like the last brew of the day will be a Kroisen, and it'll drop the very next morning. So it's just hitting high Kroisen. And you drop it in as a portion of the secondary fermentation, and you close the tank up, and the tank naturally builds up pressure, and it's natural carbonation.
Okay.
It's a tried and true method that that I'm very familiar with because Budweiser's Kroisened. I was astounded to see when I came to Anchor that it's the exact same rate, like Kroisened at the same rate at a different
very
temperature
cool.
but at different temperature and time, but the same. That 15% is a magical number for Kroisening, and it really helps the beer age very consistently. And it's one of the hallmarks of consistency of Budweiser is the beer finishes out the same. And so for Anchor Steam, we do the same thing. And that was something that Fritz added to the process, in the late 60s. He figured that out. And I don't, heard him tell the story, but I don't recollect exactly where he got the notion of croising.
Yeah.
But it really helped make the process very repeatable.
Mm-hmm.
So that croisening is key to our process. And then we do a secondary aging of 12 more days for steam beer.
Cool.
And that's also 60 degrees in the cellar. But it's actually a little warmer than that when it gets into the cellar, but the cellar is cooled at 60 degrees, so eventually it gets down to 60 degrees, and then on the 12th day, we'll cool the tank down to crash it.
Right. So you're jacketed in the cellar.
Every tank in the cellar has individual jacket and hookups for CO2, and they're all pressure-rated tanks and all that good stuff.
Cool. All right, so we're going to take a brief break, and we'll be right back with more Anchor and Scott Ungerman.
Come in a bit.
Bogart has made much progress over the past year since their grand opening. They are a growing community of professional freelancers, entrepreneurs, and startups. Their dedicated team guarantees you receive a productive and worry-free work environment. 100 Bogart is currently filling up their 2-person to 12-person private offices. The spacious pop-up gallery, premier rooftop, and brand new full floor with terrace are available for your next event. Podcast rooms, conference rooms, and meeting spaces are also available for booking. 100 Bogart hosts events like art exhibitions, pop-up stores, product launches, and fashion shows. Heritage Radio Network is a proud member of the 100 Bogart community and often holds events in the building. Visit 100bogart.com to schedule a tour and learn more.
And we're back with Scott Ungerman, from brewmaster of Anchor. And let's see, he's going to open a Brewer's Pale Ale Citra Hop Blend. Ooh, I don't think I've ever had this beer.
No, this is new.
This is brand new? All right.
This
excellent.
Is new. So yeah, we got a couple of, actually, the next couple of beers that we have are very new.
Cool.
And so we figured we'd talk about, you know, we talked the history of Anchor, and I'll lead into this with another history lesson from Anchor Brewing.
We love history lessons.
That's mine.
We're rinsing and
we're doing the glass.
Oh, he rinsed.
Yep. Okay, so that is rinsed. I'm pouring.
Yeah.
All right, so I'm pouring you a Brewer's Pale Ale, but first I'm going to talk about Liberty Ale, because Liberty Ale is such a special beer, and we don't have any, but I'm going to tell you the story anyway.
It really is. This is dedicated to John Nagley, by the way.
Yeah.
John's a Liberty
Ale guy. He's a Liberty Ale guy.
I have a Liberty Ale friend.
All time.
I have a Liberty Ale friend, and it's funny. He's got, like, two beers that are his go-to beers, and it's Liberty Ale and Racer 5, which are not very identical
beers.
No, not at all.
But they're
classics in their
own
right.
Yeah, they're both, and so that's, like, he starts there, and then he'll branch out. But, yeah, Liberty Ale is a super important beer historically, not just to Anchor, but to everybody, really. And I'm saying everybody.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because it's really the birth of dry hopping in America started with Fritz Maytag in 1975 when he decided he wanted to branch out and make a third new beer. And this is, like, he had owned the brewery for 10 years at this point.
Third, there was steam, and what were the
Porter.
Steam and porter. Okay, yeah.
So steam and then porter. And porter, yeah. I mean, if you look at, so just where Fritz was, 1965 America, homogenous, golden lagers. Those ones that I listed that I drank in college, the Schmitz and the Wiedemanns and the Schlitz and the Pabst and et cetera, that was everything. Everything was the same kind of golden lager beer. They had their subtle differences, but not very much, right? And steam beer was this quirky little beer on the West Coast that is caramel colored and fruity esters and a little more bitter, actually kind of a lot more bitter than a lot of those beers. But I think historically, like, those golden lagers in the mid-60s, mid-70s were in the 20 IBU range, not as light on the bitterness as they are today. Budweiser's 10 today,
mm-hmm.
Bud Light 6.
clap.
Yeah. Six. Amazing.
Nick Ulcher's three. So we'll stop talking about those. But anyway, that like kind of sea of homogenous lager was what existed, and steam was so different. And then 7 years into the owning of Anchor, Fritz decided he was going to innovate, make a new beer, and he made a porter. So he went completely the opposite direction. Like, I'm going to make something totally dark and different. And it was really the rebirth of a porter. There were no porters being brewed in America. First post-prohibition porter made in America, Anchor Porter, San Francisco, 1972. 3 years later, Fritz decided it was time to release yet another new beer. Think about that. How many new beers have you made in the last And so, yeah, he waited 7 years for the first innovation and 3 more years, and it was time to innovate again. And Liberty Ale was actually brewed on April 18th, 1975, to commemorate Paul Revere's ride. So the bicentennial was coming up, and people were all excited about that. And so this was like a precursor of the bicentennial, the 200th anniversary of Paul Revere's ride, saying the British are coming, right? And what was Fritz bringing? A British pale ale. Dry hopped, too. Something that was another lost art and didn't exist. And so the birth of dry hopping in America happened in 1975 with Liberty Ale, and Fritz devised a method that he had only read about in books, you know, because nobody was doing it. And so he had to come up with the concept, right? And so we've made this beautiful beer ever since then, and it's a wonderful beer in its own right. But by modern standards, it's not all that hoppy. It was the hoppiest beer in America. It was the hoppiest beer in America in 1975. But we dry hop it at about a half a pound per barrel.
Half a pound per barrel, yeah.
Half a pound per barrel. And think about
and
that.
Is it a single hop?
Yeah,
it is. Cascade. It's all Cascade.
And it's at the two time, row and Cascade. It's essentially, it's a smash, right? Right. But yeah, Cascade was brand new. He introduced the Cascade hop.
How did he get Cascade?
The hop growers, he had relationships with hop growers because he would go up there and, you know, he bought his own hop. And up until that point, it was all Northern Brewer. I mean, that's what's in steam. That's what's in Porter.
Yeah.
We started using Nugget and Steam in the 80s, but it was, back then, Anchor Steam was a single hop as well with Northern Brewer. And one of the hop growers, I don't know which one, I wish I did, but said, Fritz, we've got this new hop variety we're working on called Cascade.
And Siegel?
He smelled it. It might have been. We still buy hops from Siegel.
Yeah.
And we still buy Cascade from Siegel. So it may have been John Siegel.
Good guy. And
yeah, we'll give a shout out to John.
His family, yeah.
Yeah, but that was the introduction of the Cascade hop, and Fritz smelled the hop, and that was what inspired him to dry hop. He's like, I don't want to lose this in the kettle.
Right.
I need to put it on the cold side, and so he devised a method, basically mesh bags in the tank, aging on top of them.
And these were repressed whole. Hops at the time.
Still are. Liberty Ale still made with all whole cone hops, and all of our beers we hop in the kettle with whole cone hops. But that brings us really to today, and with Brewer's Pale Ale. And Brewer's Pale Ale is kind of a revolving hop blend. This is our second iteration. We came out earlier this year with a Nelson blend. This is the Citra blend, and so this is, you know, our take on a modern pale ale. Dry hop much more aggressively, with Citra and a blend of some other hops in there. There's some El Dorado and...
But just to lift the Citra, right?
Yeah, to lift the Citra. There's actually some Cascade in there, too.
Yeah.
But it's a nice, tasty beer, and it's drier and lighter, a little lower alcohol than...
Super drinkable.
Yeah, and that's... The idea behind Brewer's Pale Ale is that we asked our brewers, what do you want to drink? What do you want to make?
Right.
And they want to make a beer they want to drink. Yes. And they want to make a beer they can drink all day, because that's what brewers do. I mean, that's why you got into this business.
Right? And so the Brewer's Pale, is that available naturally as well?
Yeah.
It is. And you say it's rotating with the hops.
Yeah.
How often do you change?
This is the second hop blend. So we released the first one like 6 months ago. So every 6 months is kind of what we're going to... We've already got an eye on Galaxy for the next blend. like that.
Because you can get it. Right
now. Yeah, yeah. We've got some Galaxy coming.
Yeah.
So, actually, we have it. We already have it. It showed up.
This is delightful.
It's really nice. it's a crisp, drinkable pale ale, but with a hop pump. And
what's the ABV on this?
5.3.
5.3.
Yeah.
And in perspective, like starting with 0.5 or half a pound of dry hops in 1975, where are we at now with this one?
This is right around 2.5.
Around 2.5. Yeah.
We find that to be kind of our sweet spot with our technology. Yeah. The mesh bag technique was what we used for years, and it's Anchor did not make an IPA until 2013. So we had Liberty Ale.
Yeah,
and that was
the original IPA.
Yeah, it was the original, goddammit. And that was kind of our stance. That was definitely Fritz's stance. Yeah. I'm not getting into this IPA thing because, we make Steam Beer and we make Liberty Ale. And
it started that.
And, but we decided in 2013 that we were going to make our first IPA. And, you always learn by doing things that sometimes don't work out all that well. Sure. And that first IPA, it was a really nice beer, but one of the things we learned was just putting in more bags doesn't really, and more bags of whole cone hops, you get diminishing returns.
Yeah.
And you lose a lot of beer.
Yeah.
And that was one of the drivers for getting new technology. Yeah, because the bags just, they swell up full of beer, and they also, they'll form a dam, because we have horizontal aging tanks. So they'll form a literal dam in front of the outlet of the tank, and beer gets stuck behind them, and you can't get that beer out. And so you lose beer in the hops, and then you lose beer behind the hops. And we decided, and you don't get quite the aromatic pop by just adding more and more hops. So we went to a flow-through technology got inspired by our friends up at Sierra with their Torpedo. We built something similar, but we kind of reverse flow. But it's basically something we can pack full of hops. And we use cones and pellets now in that, because you can really get them densely packed in there. And then
so you send flow, it through and recirc, and then through. You leave it in there, and then it's
yeah, recirc. We'll do a 48-hour recirc that turns the tank over a couple of times. And then those hops, after 48 hours, we'll press the beer out and drop the hops out. If we want to double dry hop it like we do for this beer, we'll load another load in there and do it again.
Cool.
So that was among my next question. So it's like the idea of single charge with twice the amount, or like the double dry hopping, and how much contact time you have found to have been a sweet spot
for us. 48 hours is what's working. We've done some 72 hour ones, and we feel like you kind of start to get, it gets a little grassy, herbaceous, and especially because we're using pellets and leaf, but then we're using some cryo hops now too, so we kind of got that intensity. This beer has some cryo hops in it.
Cool. Yeah. How do you feel about cryo hops versus pellet hops? In your experience?
It's just another. It's a form of pellet. I mean, it's concentrated, and it's naturally concentrated. I actually like the concept. I've been to the pellet plant and seen what they do, and all they're doing is getting it cold and shaking it.
Mm-hmm.
And it works.
Yeah.
And so I'm a fan. So we've been using those increasingly.
We found that
in our new beer,
that alone, it's not as successful as long as it supports other.
Totally agree, and that's where, definitely we use a blend of hops, and that's why that one's called the Citra Blend, because we've got a blend of hops, and the next beer we're going to taste is our IPA, our newest IPA, Fogbreaker, and that's got a blend of hops that includes Citra Cryo. So we're using Citra whole cone in this, with some other hops, some Simcoe and a couple other things. And then, try to do this quietly.
No, it's fine.
There it is, right out. Yeah, sound effects.
Natural sound.
Here's another sound effect.
All right.
There it is. That's a good one. That is everybody's favorite sound effect. Because it means more beer. So this is Fogbreaker IPA. So an IPA dry hop, same method, using what we call our Taco Cat.
Taco Cat, that's Mary's favorite thing.
Taco Cat, is Taco Cat spelled backwards?
Taco Cat, and that's exactly why. So, as I said, we visited our friends up in Chico to look at their torpedo process. And within 5 minutes of being there, we're like, well, we can't do that. Because they just got a lot of space there.
Yeah.
Chico's wide open places. Yeah. Have you been to that brewery?
No.
It's a beautiful brewery.
I've heard the tale of more.
Yeah.
More space.
It's wide open. And so they can move around these giant torpedoes with ease and dump them outside and all that. And we have a very cramped, we're in a city.
Yeah.
And we don't have a lot of space. And so we needed to design something that did essentially the same thing, flow through hopping. So we worked with Mueller out in Springfield, Missouri, who they were recommended. They built some of the torpedoes, and we told them what we wanted, and they came up with basically it's a repurposed hop back. So designed for the hot side, but we're using it on the cold side. And it comes in with tangential flow into the thing, and then you can bleed out the space and press the beer through the hops. But it is essentially the reverse flow of a torpedo. So we called it, quite cleverly, we thought, the Odeprot.
Odeprot.
Torpedo backwards.
Backwards, yes.
If you look at it in a mirror. And so we thought that was a funny name. And somehow we really thought it was a good idea to release a beer called Odeprot. And we also didn't think to ask Sierra whether they thought that was a good idea or not.
Then
we got a letter.
Yeah, yeah.
from Ken.
And you're not
a very nice letter.
Yeah.
But it was just a limited release one time thing. But we realized that if we can't call it Odeprot anymore, we got to rename it. So we renamed it Taco Cat, because Taco Cat is the same backwards, and we figured we wouldn't get in trouble.
Yeah.
And we haven't yet.
That's
but
good.
We're not going to name a beer Taco Cat.
Fair enough. So tell us about the Fogbreaker then. This has Citra Cryo.
Yeah, it has Citra Cryo and a couple other hops in there. The idea, if you look at it, it's not a hazy IPA. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is, we just opened our tap room. I was telling you, your brewery looks a lot like our pilot brewery across the street. We opened this beautiful tap room, and we're making now a new beer every week, because that's what a pilot brewery does, right? And selling it directly to the public, and we're making tons of hazy IPAs because that's what people want. It's not the only thing we're making, but I'm sure you got a hazy IPA. Yeah.
Couple. Yes.
But we came out with this beer in the springtime last year, and we actually called it Pineapple Express when it came out, because that's the storm systems that come in from the South Pacific in the springtime that just dump rain on the West Coast. And we made this beer and intentionally not a hazy IPA, because we had made like three hazy IPAs in a row, and it was time to make something not hazy. And this one just smelled like when you open one of those cans of pineapple juice to me. I believe it's the Citra Cryo. I mean, we've got, like I said, a couple other hops supporting it in there, and I think that's really important. That same thing that you said, the cryo hops are nice, but can't use them just that. You got to have, and so it's balanced out with some Eureka and Denali. Denali's definitely in there, and distinctly pineapple on the nose to me.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And distinctly not hazy, and so that's the name Fogbreaker
came about because cutting through the fog.
Yeah. And Potrero Hill, where our brewery is actually the sunniest spot in San Francisco. There is a lot of fog in our city, especially in the summertime. So came out in the summertime, actually September, so the end of the summer.
San Francisco summer.
Yeah.
It's actually not foggy there now. So October's the nicest month.
I like it. It's my favorite month here, too, I think.
What's the ABV on this one?
It is 6.8.
Cool.
So, yeah, it's up the ladder a little bit.
This is crisp and dry, too, though.
Yeah, it's really nice. We've been working on our mash portfolio, our mash profile to dry out the beers. These specifically are pale ale and our IPAs. We do have some other beers that have some sweetness and some roundness to them, but you know that I believe in this style of beer.
Yeah.
You know that dry, slightly biscuity note really plays well with a big bouquet of hops.
For sure. Yep. Are you doing single infusion mashes then for most things?
So we have a temperature profile mash. So we'll come in at a protein rest temperature down around, you know, 115, 118, and then ramp up into the conversion zone, which it's a little quirky because our temperature is... it's not controlled. It's controlled by humans, with a valve like a steam valve that is an actual wheel valve.
That's amazing.
And then there's a temperature gauge that they're looking at. Yeah. Yeah, and so
we come in a little low.
Oh yeah,
it's got a
big beefy agitator. Okay. Awesome agitation. Yeah. So it stirs the hell out of it, and it's steam jacketed. It's 1950s technology, though. It is a human opening a valve and watching a temperature probe come up and then closing the valve and expecting like a 2-degree drift up. So we set our conversion temperature at 145, knowing that we're going to drift a little bit up.
Right.
You know, and have traditionally fairly short conversion times, but we've opened them up to longer conversion times for these beers. But it's all still, just all malt. We've made some double IPAs and things that we've added some dextrose and things like that. And we made a Mexican lager where we added some flake corn. But pretty much traditional brewing practices on the floor where you see the picture of the brewer there stirring with a paddle. That actually happens. Like we'll dump the hops into the kettle and you gotta
make sure they get in there.
You gotta stir with the big wooden oar. Yeah.
Awesome.
And your guys are doing you've got your 1,000-generation old lager yeast for the steam. Do you have a single yeast strain you're using for the lagers or for the ales, or are you
pretty much traditionally we've had the one lager strain and the one ale strain. We'll bring in some different yeasts if we're like doing a saison or something. We'll bring in a kind of limited time yeast. San Francisco was an IPA that we made over the summer, like our summer seasonal, a fruited IPA with apricot and peach and a whole lot of hops. And we used a blend of our ale yeast and Sactoir. Are you familiar with that one?
Yeah,
and it's delicious. We didn't bring that beer, sorry. Just talking about it.
So
you can still find it out there.
We've been toying with fruiting beers, and we have some things that are just taproom only, particularly because with the stability, we're putting some of the fruit in sometimes after fermentation. We won't even give crowlers up because we don't trust the volatility of that thing. So at what point are you doing kind of some of these fruit additions and dealing with that?
We do the fruit addition for that beer actually in the Taco Cat. We can throw fruit puree into that and then recirculate, and it just infuses. And so that's in our secondary fermentation.
Okay. Cool.
So we ferment out the sweetness, and then we also flash pasteurize, we don't have that concern.
We don't have that.
So we flash pasteurize everything that we package.
Cool.
Sorry, that was me. I kicked the crown.
So now for the
now here we go.
I'm so
it's
excited.
Time for Christmas
ale. This is a classic. Everything.
Yeah, we're fast forward yourself into the holiday season. I know Halloween's not even here yet.
No, but let's get to Christmas. Every day is Christmas.
Every day is Christmas.
So this beer is legendary, and
This
has such an impact on all of us as old school brewers' life. I mean, just the inspiration and the fun and the flavors and the aging capabilities of this beer are just awesome.
Awesome.
Great intro, because one of the things I'm going to talk about, one of the goals that we've had, so for me, you know, coming to Anchor, there's sound effect again, coming to Anchor after, you know, having this reverence my entire life, and especially a reverence for Christmas Ale, to be, you know, suddenly in charge of making Christmas Ale, to have that put upon me, right, is a huge and daunting task, right? Like, I have this beer,
yes.
I can't screw it up. this was amazing. And so the first year in 2014, when I joined the company, I just kind of sat back and watched, right? Like, I joined Anchor in April, and I had been there literally a week, and we were talking about Christmas Ale in April.
Yeah.
Like, wow. But somebody mentioned it's time to start thinking about Christmas Ale. I said, okay. Right on. Let's go. And so I just sat back and watched. And it was, for me, magical and interesting. And, you know, Mark Carpenter was still the brewmaster when I came on. And I had a nice, long transition with Mark where I was kind of in charge of more just like the production aspects, and Mark was still the brewmaster, and then he fully retired. He was semi-retired, and he fully retired and become brewmaster emeritus like a year later. So I had a full year overlap.
That's awesome.
And handoff with a guy who had been Fritz's right-hand man since the late 60s.
Wow.
Like,
that's a good
36
good
years of brewing experience.
Yeah.
You know, just an amazing amount of time. Or more than that. I don't even know how many years that is. I can't even do the math. I should be able to, but then I have to tell you how old I am. Let me see. That's when I was two. Learning what they did for Christmas Ale all those years and seeing how every year the new recipe builds off the last recipe.
Yeah.
So that's where it starts. What did we do last year? Okay, what are we going to take out? What are we going to put in? And it's always a secret, right? So mm-hmm. I know people, you know, who really revere this. Like, they enjoy the secret. They don't want to be told what's in it, but they definitely want to guess.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. that's what a lot of the
But, and it's funny, because people ask me, well, can you tell me about what was in past Christmas Ales? And then I'll give up a couple. Well, we don't use orange flower water anymore, okay? So, they tried frankincense once, and it didn't work out so well. The frankincense year, I forget which year it was, but...
But this has been made consecutively for how many years?
Since 1976.
Straight since 1976, yeah.
Yeah, and so I actually have that first bottle. Like, no I had
way.
That... It was one of the few bottles that I had in my collection that wasn't from my dad. It was from my sister's friend's dad, who was, like... kind of unfortunate circumstances. He like got kicked out of the house. They were getting a divorce, and his beer bottle collection had to go. And she was like, "Do you want to come over? And do you want any of them?" And I came over, and I said, "That Christmas Ale, hell yeah, I want that." So I got a 1976 Christmas Ale from Ralph Kling. Shout out to Ralph.
Shout out to Ralph.
No longer with us.
Sorry, Ralph.
Cheers to Ralph.
Cheers, Ralph.
Anyway. The Christmas Ales of my youth, like, inspired me. Like, that trip that I made to Anchor in 1987, one of the most amazing things was it was during, it was definitely, I think it was in November, because they had that year's Christmas Ale and they had the previous year's, and we got to taste both of them side by side. That for me was like, how cool is that? We got to taste the 87 and the 86. And 86 was a remarkable year. Still, like, people call out, like, the old school people.
The 86.
And there was a guy who brought some by the brewery a couple of years ago, like 86, that he found in his grandpa's basement or something like that. And it was just terrible. I mean, beer doesn't age. Not in grandpa's basement.
Yeah.
I mean, it tasted like shoe polish and sherry. And my, you know, my grandma's ashtray.
All three of which are delicious.
Yeah, well, no, yeah. Just nice. But it is, you know, the aging of this beer is really important to us. And it's one of the things we've done over the last 3 years is
really focus on what's this beer going to age like and how are we going to make it age better. And so one of the things that we did, just a simple technical thing, was really rather easy. We upped the alcohol. So it had been 5.5 forever until 3 years ago. And then we went up 6.5, 6.7, this year it's 6.9. So it's a bigger beer. But this one is really kind of a throwback to some earlier Christmas. Down on the spice note, up on the hops note. Mm-hmm. You see that Korean pine on the label. We really wanted the beer to have that aromatic, that pine tree aromatic. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in the past, you know, sometimes it's been towards spice cake or you know, really intense spicy aromas, herbaceous, that kind of thing. This year we were focused on pine. Yeah. We were focused specifically on Christmas trees.
Cool.
Like, let's make Christmas ale smell like a Christmas tree again. Mm-hmm. That was the idea behind this particular one. And we took out, and the last couple of years it had also got big roasty malts in it, which I really liked, but this year was a departure from that. It's more of that mahogany brown.
Yeah.
I feel like it's going to age super well.
Yeah.
And
it's very balanced too. It's not like in your face Christmas tree. It's a very,
we actually went back to dry hopping too. So there's a little more hops in it this year.
It seems like not just
the other things. You have to have some other things. There has to be that. What is that spice? Where does that come from? And we actually did some toasting of spices ourselves this year too. Which we bought a wok.
That's awesome.
and we macerate with a baseball bat.
A wooden baseball bat.
Not a mortar and pestle, but plastic bucket and wooden baseball bat.
Because how much of this do you make every year?
This year, we're expecting to sell about 6,000 barrels of Christmas ale. Mm-hmm. Which is about what we did last year, so it's pretty stable.
Yeah,
it's interesting. That's Christmas ale for us.
How early does it come out?
It comes out November 1st.
Okay.
Although some people jump the gun.
Okay.
But we want it to come out November 1st. Yeah. That Christmas creep. Christmas before Halloween.
It's a week from.
It's a week from Thursday.
Today, yeah. Which this is going to play on Thursday, so it's a week from today.
And you will be able to find it out here, definitely. And we have it in six packs on draft and in magnums. And the magnums are like that's what it's a great size for sharing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for parties.
We had a Christmas party last year for the New York City Home Brewers Guild here, and a guy brought a five or six
magnums. They come six to a case.
Yeah.
Six.
No, he brought a vertical.
6 years. Oh, yeah. That's nice.
The last 6 years, yeah.
Excellent.
They were all delicious too, but very different.
They vary quite a bit. And that's part of the fun of it. That's the mystery of what's it going to be like this year. But we're really happy with this one. I mean, we're always happy with it. I have to say. You got to be proud of your beers.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And your kids, right? That's it. Yeah. Proud of your beers and your kids, that's it.
And your dogs were in New York
dogs,
City.
Dogs, yeah. My dog. We bought our dog a Halloween costume. I was just telling Tegan about.
We have a costume competition this Sunday at the brewery.
Awesome,
so
it's really a simple costume, but it's hilarious because he's like a mini poodle, and it's... It's like a strap-on saddle with a little jockey.
Yes.
So, and he's like a spaz. He runs all over the place, and the jockey's like, it's pretty awesome.
We saw a Dalmatian yesterday that kind of has like the spots that are kind of big enough to be kind of cow-like. Mm-hmm. And so the owners were thinking of taking some cardboard to drape over them, say, eat more chicken.
Oh, perfect.
Pretty good, yeah.
That's good.
Yep.
So what's next? For Anchor. What's now that the Christmas ale Christmas is almost ale. Out, what do you guys think about this time of year?
We are thinking about our winter release of our limited release. We're, I think, not fully announcing who it's with, but it's a local San Francisco company. And it's going to be an IPA, a super tasty IPA. And that's made with some local ingredients and really kind of local San Francisco focused.
Will we be able to find that on the East Coast as well, or is that?
I think so. I think it's nationally available. It should be available. Like if you found San Francisco, if you can find San Francisco, which you can find, we have a beer finder online.
Okay.
So if you go to anchorbrewing.com, there's a beer finder on there.
What's that?
Slash beer finder.
But if you go to anchorbrewing.com, you can find on the little buttons on the top.
Yeah.
Beer finder. Boom. Click. And you just put in your zip code and the brands that you're looking for, and boom. San Francisco.
And if people, so I know, to tour the actual brewery, you guys book like months in advance.
See, that's a fallacy.
That's not.
It's a myth. Urban myth. It used to be the case.
Okay.
So for years, like back when I toured the brewery, you had to book in advance. You could only call, and you could only call between like 8 and 5. And so, I mean, it was totally old school. Somebody write down your name and put you on and say, you know, okay, you want a Saturday, it's 3 months out. You know, or we didn't even do weekend tours, actually. Back in the day, it was just 5 days a week, 2 tours a day. And then a few years back, we opened up weekend tours. We put it online. And now we have 3 tours a day on Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And so we opened up a lot more tours to accommodate the demand of people wanting to come. And now, like midweek tours, you can get on next day.
Awesome.
If you're coming to San Francisco and you want to tour the brewery, you don't have to plan months in advance. You can book a tour in the middle of the week. On the weekend, it's still... Like, there's an 11 a.m. tour that I think you can get on with relatively short notice, but then the 1:30 in the afternoon and the 4 o'clock in the afternoon are booked pretty far in advance if you were looking for Friday, Saturday, Sunday. But those 11 a.m. tours, I was there on Sunday, and there were, like, we have 30 spots in our tour, 35 spots in our tour, and there couldn't have been more than 25 people.
Cool. And then you mentioned you built this pilot brewery. And that has a tasting room as well?
Yeah. And that's open to the public 7 days a week.
Okay. Awesome.
So, and no reservation needed. It's just, it's kind of an indoor-outdoor beer garden and warehouse space. I mean, similar flow and vibe to what you have here with open tables. Not one as cool as this, but the game.
I take a lot of pride
the
in this.
Game table
the game table
is awesome.
Although apparently I screwed it up because chess versus checker. Well, there's that.
Yeah.
But there's chess versus checker, I guess.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The white square needs to be on the bottom right to be a chess board. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I wouldn't have known that. But your backgammon spot on? Is your backgammon?
I think I
love backgammon.
I think that one's fine.
And look, you can play backgammon with bottle caps.
That's right.
We need to make.
That's
so you have a lot of taproom exclusives in that one.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
That
so
may
we
find
are,
their way to...
yeah, and that's the... I didn't tell the story of Fogbreaker completely, but I kind of alluded to it. But this is our first beer to come out of, to graduate from the pilot program. So we first made it in the spring, and then it came out in September in a bottle as our latest release. So it's the first thing that was brewed there. We loved it, sold out right away, and we're like, okay, we got to go. This is the one. You know, we knew we wanted to bring out an IPA in the fall, and that was the one.
Well, we are out of time, unfortunately, but this has been a true pleasure sitting down with you and tasting through these beers.
And on behalf of the brewers everywhere, thanks for paving the way of the whole Anchor Steam team, you know.
Yeah, amazing.
Yep.
You gotta raise a glass to Fritz on that one.
Oh, yeah, man. For sure.
And he's still... Fritz is... People ask this question. One last thing. People do ask about Fritz. How's he doing? He's doing great. Saw him less than a year ago. He came out of the brewery. And we have a couple of people at the brewery still in regular contact with him. We actually have a brewery historian.
Oh, yeah.
Like, how many breweries?
That's pretty hip.
There's a goal for your brewery.
Yeah.
Have a historian someday.
Yeah.
But anyway, raising the glass for Fritz and this year's Christmas ale.
Yeah.
Thanks
Cheers.
Again for...
No, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for...
Now let's see some of your beers.
Yeah, all right.
Cheers. Foment about it.
Foment about it.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, listeners, we're nearing the end of our 15th anniversary fundraising campaign, and we need your help to meet our goal. This campaign offers you a chance to win a unique food and music experience in one of the most exciting cities in America. Here's how it works. Donate to HRN and you'll be entered to win dinner for two and two tickets to a concert in one of eight amazing cities: New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Nashville, Las Vegas, Charleston, Ardmore, Pennsylvania, and Asheville. All donations support our work educating food system storytellers. And when you donate, you can choose one of those cities and you'll be entered to win dinner and two tickets to a show. So help us reach our goal and enter to win dinner and a show in the city of your choice. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15. Thank you.